So we are nearing the home stretch for the book of Acts, right? The final two chapters, and today is our second last study in the book. And the second half of Acts, of course, has been about the journeys of Paul. He's made three missionary trips. The first one was in Asia Minor in the region of Galatia. The second one, he went into Macedonia and Greece to Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea and Athens and Corinth. And then on the third one, he spent most of his time in Ephesus. But Paul is about to begin his final journey, right? This is in 59 AD. And it's not like the others in that this isn't a missionary journey per se, right? Paul is in Roman custody, and they're going to take him to Rome. And that's because he appealed to Caesar when he was before Festus, the Roman governor in Caesarea. And he did that when Festus wanted to send him back to Jerusalem. Paul didn't want to do that because they know they were waiting to kill him there. And as we talked about, this is where Paul has wanted to go all along, right? For a long time, to Rome. So as we begin chapter 27, you're going to see the pronoun we, which means that Luke, the author, is now with Paul. Right? This is the first time Luke has included himself in the narrative since chapter 21. And that was at the end of Paul's third journey when he arrived in Jerusalem. I don't know if Luke joined up at some point in Caesarea or maybe he's been with him this whole time. But right from the first couple of verses here, we can tell it's Luke because he's going to write with a lot of detail, right? Lots of names and places, which is why I produced the maps here. And of course, whenever Luke writes like that, it just demonstrates the accuracy and the reliability of Scripture. So, verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So entering a ship of, Adramidium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. So the Augustan regiment there, that's also translated cohort, which would have been between 500 and 1,000 soldiers. So that's how many would have been on this ship. And Adramidium is a port city on the west coast of Asia Minor. Which doesn't have that word. Oh, there it is. It's up near the top there. And that's actually near Troas, where Paul went on his third journey, and so that's where the ship was from. And I think the purpose of this detail was probably to indicate that this was a coastal ship, right? They intended to sail along coastlands, as verse 2 says, and then change ships and go out to the open sea. So in that opening there, there's a name that we have seen before, and that is Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. We saw him in chapter 19 with Paul in Ephesus. He was seized during the riot there. In Colossians 4:10, which was written from Rome, Paul calls Aristarchus my fellow prisoner. So apparently he went with Paul all the way to Rome. So the ship sets sail from Caesarea and goes and makes a quick jaunt north up the coast on what was then Syria to another familiar city. So Ed, can you read verses 3 through 6, please?
And the next day they landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the wind was contrary. And when we sailed over the sea, which was off Sicilia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycus, Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexander ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board.
Sorry for giving you all those names there. So Sidon has been mentioned several times in Scripture, often together with Tyre. As you see in verse 3, Paul had friends there, which makes sense since Jesus went there during his ministry to Sidon. That is where the Gentile woman asked Jesus to cast a demon out of her daughter. And that's when Jesus said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. And so people came from Sidon to hear Jesus preach and be healed. And he spoke favorably of Tyre and Sidon. So this is probably like a second generation church in Sidon. And then they sail on to the Mediterranean Sea, to the island of Cyprus, south of Asia Minor. Again, they need to stick as close as possible to land since this is a coastal ship. Verse 4 says the winds were contrary, and that's just a small foreshadowing of what's to come, right, as far as sailing conditions. So they sail north and along the southern coast of Asia Minor. That's where Cilicia and Pamphylia are. Remember, Cilicia is Paul's native region, right? That's where Tarsus is. Then they came to Myra in the province of Lycia. It's on the southwestern coast. And that's where they change ships. You get on a bigger ship that can sail across the sea to Italy. And again, in verse 6, Luke says where this ship is from, which would tell his readers what kind of ship it is. While the first ship was from a city that's on the smaller Aegean Sea, Alexandria was a large port city that was directly on the Mediterranean, right? You can see it there on the coast of Egypt. And so the ships there would be bigger. And from there, they set off on the Mediterranean Sea. And then you see the conditions start to get treacherous there. So, Fred, can you read 7 and 8?
Sure. When we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulties off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. Past it through with difficulties, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Laodicea.
All right, so sailing on the open sea is difficult and dangerous even today. Right? Imagine what it was like back then in their wooden ships with no technology. Right? In those two verses, we see the word difficulty twice. The Greek word means they barely made it. Verse 7 shows us in several ways how hard this journey was going to be. Right? The first stop is in Cnidus, which is a small island off the coast of Asia Minor. Luke says it took many days just to get from Myra to Cnidus. You can see in your map there, it's not that far. And it's still going along the coast. So it sounds like they wanted to keep sailing west to Greece, but they couldn't because of the winds. So they sailed south to the island of Crete, which is a little out of the way, but the island would calm the conditions. Verse 8 says it was still difficult, and they arrived at Fair Havens, which is on the southern coast of Crete. Verse 9 says they stayed there quite a while. So, Noah, can you redo 9 and 10?
Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives."
Right. In verse 9, the fast refers to the Day of Atonement. It's the only annual fast required in the Law of Moses. And the passage about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 23 says, "You shall afflict your souls," right? That indicates a fast. And since this is the Day of Atonement, that means this is in the fall and winter is approaching. And that's why Luke says sailing was now dangerous. So with the conditions getting worse, Paul predicts in verse 10 that this voyage will end with disaster and that they'll all die. Right? I mean, that's probably not like a supernatural prophecy, but I think it's just his sailing experience from his journeys, right? He knows what it's like in different times of the year. He wrote in 2 Corinthians 11:25 that he had already been shipwrecked 3 times, right? So he knows what not to do. And he will get a word from God further down. So Paul wanted them to stop and spend the winter in Fair Havens. And this is the first parallel I see here to the story of Jonah. All right, remember when we talked about Peter in chapter 10, we compared him to Jonah, right? Because they were both called to the Gentiles. And while Jonah fled in the other direction, Peter obeyed and went, right? Both from the city of Joppa. So in a way, this kind of picks up Jonah's story from there, right? Because Jonah was also on a ship on the Mediterranean Sea heading west, and they also ran into stormy seas. The difference is, in the storm, Jonah hid in the lowest part of the ship and fell asleep. Even though he knew the storm was because of him, the crew had to confront him for Jonah to sacrifice himself. Paul, on the other hand, he cares about the safety of the crew. And so he's the one who, like, proactively confronts them. Right? And so, and I'm going to talk more about Jonah a little further down. But we see next that the Romans didn't listen.
Wanted to say, I noticed that it's interesting. It said the fast was already over. So Paul had been fasting prior to, you know, this account. So it probably the Lord was putting on his heart at that point that all this was going to happen to the ship and was speaking to Paul because, you know, when we fast, that's when the Lord really can speak to us because we put everything aside and we're just listening for his voice. But, you know, I just think it's very relevant that he mentions the fast here and then the revelation that this is going to happen.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. But whatever it was, whether it was this revelation or just his experience, the Romans aren't going to listen to him. And they tried sailing farther. I'll start reading from verse 11 here. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. Because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. When the south wind blew softly, supposing they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete. So as you can see on the map there, Crete is a long horizontal island. And they sailed along the southern coast with the harbor of Phoenix as their intended destination, which is near the western end of Crete. But instead, they make another bad decision. Right, verse 13 says the south wind blew softly. So apparently the weather was letting up. And they figured, well, maybe we don't need to stay here anymore. Right? That's what it means by they had obtained their desire. Right? They got shelter from the storm. So the storm seems to be letting up now, and they're thinking, well, let's see if we can make the journey now. I mean, who's in charge of this ship? There are a bunch of idiots here. I mean, verse 12 says the majority decided to do this, which means there were some who didn't, and they got outvoted. Right, and that passage also says the owner of the ship wanted to do this. I don't know if this was like a money thing or what, but this is not good here. So what happens next? I mean, you don't need to be a prophet to predict here. So let's go back around this way. Noah, can you do 14 through 17?
Not long after, a tempestuous wind had arose called
Euroclydon?
I don't know, I'm going to try. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty.
You 17, sir?
No. When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the citrus sands, they struck sail, and so were driven.
All right. Euroclydon is a compound of two words that mean east wind and north wind. So this was a nor'easter. It was a bad storm feared by sailors on the Mediterranean. Right? Luke calls it tempestuous. The storm in Jonah is also called a tempest. Verse 15 says it was so bad that they couldn't steer the ship. Right? They had to just let the storm take it wherever it took it. And they arrive in an island called Clauda. I think the map says Clauda. This is south of Crete. And I mean, that's God's providence there. I mean, of course, you know, his hand is on this ship the whole time, but they could have just drifted out to the open sea, and I mean, that would have been the end of them. And so there, on this island there, they take some steps to secure the ship and get it under control. They bring the skiff from the side of the ship onto the ship. That's like the little boat that's used for taking crew members to shore. It's also called a dinghy. And Luke is doing this too, using the first pronoun we. Remember, Luke is a physician, not a seaman here. And the skiff was probably filled with water, so all the passengers had to help secure it. And then they tied cables around the ship. And based on what I read, this was to keep planks from popping loose and leaking, right? This is called frapping. And then it says they struck sail. Now, the commentaries I read, there's some like uncertainty as to what that means. Some said that it means they lowered the sails by lowering the masts and the rigging, but not all the way. That's right. It's like they need the sails high enough to be able to steer the ship, but if they're too high, then the winds will carry them to who knows where. So it's kind of like a balancing act, trying to find just the right height. And they did all this to avoid being carried south to the Syrtis Sands. Some translations say quicksands. These were like shallow bogs on the northern coast of Africa. And they were greatly feared by sailors, because if ships got caught in those, then they would get stuck and shipwrecked. And there were two of them. And their locations were like constantly changing, so they could not be accurately charted. So they did avoid drifting south, but they set out to the sea, to the west, right, hoping to make it to Italy, which again was very unwise as winter was approaching. Maybe they thought that they could beat the weather or something, but predictably they ran into devastating storms. So Fred, can you do 18 through 20?
And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, no small tempest beat on us. All hope that we would be saved was finally given up.
All right, so now they're in the thick of it. Right, they are on the open sea, and they are just struggling to survive. Right, other translations of exceedingly tempest-tossed are severely battered by the storm and dangerously tossed about by the violence of the storm. In verse 20, where it says, "No small tempest beat on us," another translation says, "The severe storm kept raging." And so right in the thick of this now, they take measures of last resort. Right? They throw overboard the ship's equipment and cargo, which may have included food. As verse 21 will say that they stop eating. And the purpose of this... The purpose of this was that so that the ship would go faster and they would hit land sooner. And not only was the storm devastating the ship, but they had no idea where they were going. Right, and this was because, as it says, neither sun nor stars appeared for many days. They need the stars for navigation, right, to know where they are. And they need the sun to know what time it is. So if they didn't see the sun, that means there were no breaks in the weather for many days. So, like, put all that together. Right? They are lost at sea, the ship's coming apart, they're starving, they're losing all hope. right? They think they're all going to die. You know, there was a time when Jesus and the disciples were in a storm. And the disciples thought they were going to die. But just three words from Jesus delivered them, right? Peace, be still. And even though he was asleep on the boat, he was in absolute control. Even the wind and the sea obey him. Now, it doesn't go quite that way here, but the Lord is still in control. So in his sovereign omnipotence over every drop of water in the sea, the Lord has determined that this storm will not take one life. So, Ed, long passage here from 21 to 26.
But after long abstinence from food, when Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurring this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore take heart, men, for I believe that it will be just as it was told to me. However, we must run aground on a certain island.'"
So when Paul was being held in Caesarea, back in chapter 23, the Lord told him that you must also bear witness at Rome. And nothing, not the full fury of the worst storm on earth, was going to stop that. So in the midst of this storm, just as Jesus woke up and stood on the boat, the Lord speaks. And this time he does it through a messenger, an angel. Now he doesn't speak "peace be still" to the storm, but he speaks "peace be still" to Paul. Right? Do not be afraid. So maybe even Paul was starting to get worried. And that's how it often goes for us, right? You know, the Lord might not calm the storms around us, but he'll calm us. Right? It's like what Psalm 46 says. Be still and know that I am God. Right? You be still. And he'll get us through the storms. And the Lord will keep his word, right? As he always does. And he uses the same words with Paul. He says, "You must be brought before Caesar." The Lord said it will happen. It will happen. Right? It will be just as it was told me, Paul says. And not only does the Lord keep his word to Paul, but all the other crew will live because of that. Remember when Jonah was on the ship, a storm came because of him. Right? And the crew of that ship was endangered because Jonah was with them. But now, the crew of this ship is saved because Paul is with them. So once again, Paul is the greater Jonah. The way the angel puts it shows the Lord's absolute sovereignty here. God has granted you all those who sail with you. Right? Every life on earth is in God's hands. Right? He grants life as he pleases. Every minute we live has been granted to us by God. And the way Paul relays this shows God's lordship over all the peoples of the earth. Right? Paul calls him the God to whom I belong. But in sparing their lives, it's like Paul is telling them, you belong to him too. Right? Whether you serve him or not, whether you believe in him or not. And when you belong to God, you can take heart, as Paul tells them to do. And the word granted implies that Paul's been praying, right, not just for himself, but for them, as a good Christian would do. And by telling them this, this is a witness to them, right? He says, I believe God. He doesn't believe the overwhelming circumstances here, which would say that they're doomed. He believes the word of God when everything around him was at its worst. Right? As David Guzik said, God was more real to him than the storm. How real is God to us in the midst of a storm? Right? We've all gone through our storms. And when God fulfills his word and they all survive, we're going to see that they will start to believe in him too. It also reminds me of something Jesus said. In John 6:39, Jesus said, this is the will of the Father who sent me, that of all he has given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day. Right? If you're a Christian, God the Father has given you to God the Son. He has granted you, and he will not lose you. Not one. You are eternally secure. However, as it often is with us, right? Still, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be pleasant. They're still going to lose the ship. And they're going to run aground on a certain island, which is not where they intended to go. And they're still starving, and that's not fun. The Lord didn't make a multitude of fish jump onto the boat, right? Which he has done before. He could have done that. The Lord will let us suffer. All right? And I think that's related to another point here. Like, Paul is like, I told you so. You know, they shouldn't have sailed from Crete. Even though God is in control, we are still responsible for our decisions. Right? And if we make bad decisions, we will suffer the consequences. You know, Paul says they incurred this disaster and loss. Right? I mean, the Lord didn't send the storm. They just stupidly sailed right into it. And it's only God's grace and mercy that they survived. So, take a little break here. Anybody got any thoughts or questions or? Well, I'm taking a donut break. Unlike them, we have food.
This is kind of interesting. The fast is over, but the fast wasn't over.
Yeah. Imagine how hungry Paul must be right now.
I know. He's the one that did the fast, right?
Well, with that ship being tossed like it was, they probably were so sick they probably couldn't eat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I tell you, anything easy to eat would come right back up.
Yeah, he didn't lose his cookies.
Mm-hmm. All right, so they're still basically adrift at sea. All right, it'll be for 2 weeks, we'll see. And nothing's really changed except the word that God gave Paul through the angel. But then, kind of like with Noah's Ark during the flood, there start to be signs of land. All right, picking up in verse 27, it says, now when the 14th night had come, 2 weeks, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. When they had gone a little farther, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So the modern Adriatic Sea is between Greece and Italy. The map says the Sea of Adria. But that's not what's being referred to here. Here, the Adriatic refers to like the central Mediterranean Sea, right? Where you can see that's where the red line goes. So they're still in the open sea, and they're still being driven by the wind, right? Up and down, which means they're like zigzagging all around. But by God's grace, they're going in somewhat the right direction here, and they are getting closer to their destination. And then at midnight, right, the darkest hour, they sensed they were near land. Maybe the wind and the water were getting calmer. And so they took soundings. Obviously, they didn't have sonar back then, but they would like lower a rope with a weight on it to measure the depth. And then they were finally able to drop anchor. And so it's like, imagine the joy and relief at that point. They've reached land, and they are all still alive, just as Paul said. And look what they do in verse 29. They pray. These pagan Romans pray. Maybe they were praying to their gods, but I bet at least some of them prayed to Paul's God. And I bet they could tell that they are still alive because of him. Remember that Paul was a prisoner, but now, like because of his faith and his relationship with God, he's a leader. Right? Kind of like Joseph and Daniel, who rose to leadership among pagans because of God. So, all right, back around now. Ed, can you do 30 through 32?
And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the ship into the sea, under pretense of putting some anchor from the prow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldier, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the rope of the skiff and let it fall off.
All right, so the centurion was the Roman in charge of the ship, right? And this is interesting. He's the one who decided to sail from Crete, not listening to Paul's warning. So really, all of this is his fault. But here, it looks like he's learned his lesson. Listen to Paul. So some of the crew tried to escape from the ship on the skiff. They were being selfish. Right? They would have just left the rest of them behind. And they tried to do it like in a deceptive way, under pretense. Paul's like, nope. If everyone was going to survive, they needed each other. Right? They needed the expertise of the whole crew. They all had work to do. Again, even though God has said that no one will be lost, they were still responsible for their own survival. Right? Even though God is in control of our lives, we still have to work at life. Right? That we can't just sit back or run away. Right? It's like God works through our work. And next we're going to see that in another way here. So, Frank, can you do 33 and 34?
And as day was about to dawn, Paul employed them all to take food, saying, "Today is the 14th day. You have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from your head of any of you."
So again, you see the relationship between God's provision and our efforts. Right? Paul states an extraordinary promise here. Not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. Right? I mean, considering their circumstances, right, a storm and a shipwreck, I mean, that's a miracle.
Maybe they were all bald, yeah. Too.
But yeah, that's the Lord's sovereign care and protection, right? Down to the hairs on their head. Kind of like what Jesus said, the very hairs of your head are all numbered, right? Luke 12:7. However, they still had to take practical steps to survive, right? They still needed to eat. Even though God takes care of us, we should still do what we can to take care of ourselves, right? We should still think practically and prudently. And we'll see that there was still food on the ship, right? They must have been like rationing it to the extreme. But there's at least enough to, in a way, hold communion. So, Noah, can you read 35 through 38?
And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and took food themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea.
He took bread, gave thanks to God, broke it, and ate. So this could be the Lord's Supper on a wrecked ship in the middle of nowhere. Right? We know from 1 Corinthians 11 how highly Paul thought of the Lord's Supper, right? And even here, he's going to obey the Lord, right? Do this in remembrance of me. And notice that his obedience and honoring the Lord encouraged the crew. It's like they could see his faith and his devotion, even in the midst of catastrophe here, and they could see that he was for real. Right? And when the world sees that we are for real, that our faith is real, that is a witness. And others will draw strength from us as we draw strength from the Lord. In verse 37, Luke points out that there were 276 persons on the ship. Right? Again, there's Luke's penchant for detail there, but as usual, it has a purpose. First of all, it shows what an act of God it is that they all survived and that not one of them was lost. And secondly, it sets up verse 38, which says they had eaten enough. Right? I don't know how much food they had left. Again, they were probably rationing to this point. But, like, eating until they were full, that doesn't sound like something that they would do. So, it was an act of faith that they were going to be okay. Right? It was like a feast of celebration and giving thanks. This reminds me of when Jesus fed the multitude. Right? They all ate and were filled, Luke says in his gospel. In fact, they were confident enough to throw the rest of the wheat into the sea, as if they didn't think they'd need it anymore. So they're still on the ship. And again, their difficulties have not gone away. And I think, Noah, it's back to you now, right? You do 39 through 41.
When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves.
So where they arrived, they had never been there before because no one recognized it. So that kind of adds to the scary uncertainty here. Again, look at the nautical detail Luke writes with. I mean, if he wasn't a seaman before, he is now. You know, it's like some readers, you know, maybe reading this today, and they're like, well, why do we need to know all this about all these parts of the ship? About rudder ropes and the mainsail and the prow. But many of his readers at the time, they would relate to it, right? Because much of the known world surrounded a great sea. And so they would understand what a disaster this is. And remember, you know, it's not like they reached a port here. They're running aground on a beach, and they don't know where they are. And the ship is being broken up by violent waves, right? So sailors would consider that a catastrophe. And wherever they are, they're stuck there for who knows how long. You know, they miraculously survived a shipwreck, but their struggle to survive is just beginning. And so as we reach the end of the chapter, they finally get to step foot on land. Verse 42, it says, and the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose. and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard and jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. So it was Roman practice that if prisoners escaped, then whoever was guarding them would be put to death. Right, I think that's why, remember, that's why the Philippian jailer was about to kill himself after the earthquake in chapter 16. And so the centurion here, as the leader of this ship, would have been responsible for all of them. And we talked about this centurion, like how he's listening to Paul now. He knew that they were alive because of Paul. So his priority now is protecting him, right? Protecting Paul, even at the risk of his own life. Showing a lot of faith in Paul or in Paul's God, if he believed. And this is like the third or fourth time that a Roman has shown favor to Paul. Right? And that is the power of his witness, right? Which was the result of his trust in God. It's like Proverbs 16:7 says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Right? And we're going to see more of that later on. So the centurion, he stops the soldiers from killing anyone. Remember, Paul said they needed everyone to survive. And they finally make it to land. Now, we know now that they're on the island called Malta. And there's a beach on Malta today that is the traditional site of the shipwreck. It's called St. Paul's Bay. And Luke describes it dramatically here. I mean, some of them are paddling to shore on pieces of the ship. I mean, that's kind of symbolic for how it is for us sometimes, right? And sometimes our lives can look like a shipwreck, broken into pieces, but in the end, we finally make it through, even if we are just barely clinging to those pieces, right? That's what our lives are like sometimes. Reminds me of 1 Peter 4:18, which says, the righteous one is scarcely saved, meaning with difficulty. Our whole life can be a storm, but the Lord will bring us home, right? Escaping safely to land. And whatever happens to us in this life, our spirits are safe, right? We will make it to our eternal destination. And again, the Lord will not lose even one of us. So anybody got any thoughts at the end of the chapter here?
You know, I was thinking about the wheat that they threw overboard there. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the grain offering, you know, how they offered that in gratitude to the Lord, mm-hmm. that he had provided for their needs and so forth. And I was... Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a transition in heart here, you know, to me anyways. I don't know if it's meant to be that way, but I look at it as maybe these guys were finally giving thanks to the Lord for saving them, you know.
But things we're looking at.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start the final chapter of Acts. Right, we've seen God's sovereign providence through this harrowing journey and keeping them all alive, all 276 of them, making sure they're all fed. And now that they're on this cold and rainy island, and this is the dead of winter, having no idea where they are or what they'll do now, God sends them another blessing. And this is a huge one. All right, so, Noah, can you start the chapter here, verses 1 and 2?
Yeah. Now, when they had escaped, they then found out that the island was called Malta, and the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold.
Like, wow, what a blessing that is. I mean, these natives here, they're like angels from God. They're welcoming them, they're making a fire for them, and Luke calls it unusual kindness. So it's like, this is not normal. This is the Lord here. And it's another blessing that they find out where they are. right? Malta, as you can see on the map, it's an island south of Sicily, which is south of Italy. Now, they probably knew of Malta, right? They just didn't recognize this part of it, because I guess the main port was on the other side of the island. And the Lord, who promised that Paul is going to Rome, he has brought them closer to their destination. Because if they had missed Malta, they would have drifted back out to the open sea. But again, even the wind and the sea obey him. And the Lord's blessing continues in not only orchestrating their circumstances, but next, we see a miracle. All right, Brett, can you do 3 through 5?
When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer whom, though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live." But he shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm.
All right, so the Greek word for natives is barbaros. It's where we get the word barbarian. In fact, that's how the King James Version translates it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just meant that they were not Greek-speaking. Right? They didn't live in like the known civilized world. But we will see that there are Romans on the island. So in God's providence, not only did he preserve the lives of everyone on the ship and bring them through stormy seas closer to Rome, but he's brought Paul to what we would call an unreached people group. You know, in all of his travels, Paul stayed in the Greek world, right? But this is something new for him. And we'll see that he will take this opportunity to minister and witness to them, starting with this viper here. I saw one commentary that said that there was a legend at the time about people escaping a shipwreck only to die of snake bites, and that it was the justice of the gods. And so I think that's what they think is happening here. And it's interesting, they called Paul a murderer. It's interesting because that is correct. Remember when he persecuted the church, Paul breathed murder. You read that back in chapter 9. And he consented to the murder of Stephen. So Paul indeed deserved death. But Jesus took his place and suffered the death that Paul deserved. And all the way back in the Garden of Eden, Genesis 3, the Lord told the serpent that he will strike the seed of Eve, meaning Jesus. So, you could say, Jesus took the snake bite instead of Paul, so that Paul would live. Now, that doesn't mean we're all immune from snake bites. Yeah, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And I love Paul's reaction here, because, I mean, if it were me, I would freak out. And Luke, you know, the physician, he describes it with his usual detail. It didn't just bite him, but it was like hanging from his hand.
Yeah.
But no, he just calmly shakes it off. Get off me. It's like with everything he's been through, some little creature isn't going to faze him, right? And again, the Lord has said, Paul is going to Rome. And this little snake is not going to stop that. And this fulfills what Jesus said in Mark chapter 16. Why don't you turn there in your Bible? Go to Mark chapter 16. All right, Mark 16:15. And he said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." This is Jesus. "He who believes and is baptized will be saved, but he who does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will follow those who believe. In my name they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will take up serpents. And if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. So Jesus said, one of the signs that will follow those who believe is that they will take up serpents. Kind of like if Paul raised his hand and that serpent is attached to his hand, he's taking it up. But they will not be harmed. Now, that is not about the crazy Pentecostal snake handlers, right? I mean, Jesus also said they would drink poison and survive, but I don't see anybody trying to do that. And that passage in Mark, right, if he actually even said it, that whole section is disputed. It's fulfilled in the church as a whole. Not every individual believer, right? For example, Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians that not everyone will speak in tongues, right? So, I mean, that proves it's not an individual promise. It's a corporate promise for the whole church. Almost everything Jesus mentioned, right? Casting out demons, speaking in tongues, healing the sick, and now this. All of that happened in the book of Acts. And that's how it's fulfilled. So back to Acts 28. Yeah. So let's see, the natives' reaction here is actually something Paul has seen before. Ed, if you're there, can you read verse 6?
Acts 28?
Yep.
Okay. However, they were expecting that it would swell up. That it would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god.
So, back in chapter 14, during Paul's first journey, he healed a crippled man in Lystra, which is in Galatia. And the people there started calling Paul and Barnabas Hermes and Zeus. They said, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. And that greatly upset Paul, right, and Barnabas. They tore their clothes. Now, we don't see Paul's reaction here, but I bet anything he preached the gospel to them, right? And it doesn't stop them from healing people. We'll see here. I'll pick up in verse 7. It says, in that region, there was an estate of the leading citizen of the island, whose name was Publius, who received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. And it happened that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and dysentery. Paul went into him and prayed, and he laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and were healed. They also honored us in many ways. And when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. So they find the Roman governor of Malta, right? That's what leading citizen means. And in another blessing from God, he welcomes them. In verse 10, they're honored and they receive everything they need to continue their journey, right? Which we'll see will include another ship. And so this is where they will spend the winter, right? Much, much needed refuge here. So once again, Paul finds favor with those who could have been his enemies. And Paul returns the favor by healing the man's father who was sick. And word of that must have spread because many people come and are healed. And again, even though it's not mentioned here, I think it's safe to assume that Paul preached Jesus to them. And, you know, some Christians say that the miraculous gifts of the Spirit have ceased, right? They're called cessationists. And one thing that they say is that over the course of the first generation of the church, that miracles like this, like, gradually died out. But this is late in Paul's ministry. And it's about 60 AD, and he heals a whole island of people. Right? Now, I agree that healings and miracles were more common, like the closer you get to the arrival of Christ in the world, and, you know, they're a sign that the kingdom is here, that the Messiah has come. And I hear that, you know, miracles are more frequent when witnessing to, like, unreached people groups, which would be the case here. But nowhere in the Bible did God stop healing people, right? And there is nothing that says that he would stop healing at any point during the church age. God still heals. He still heals today. And this is yet more proof of God's hand over this whole journey. Right? He gets Paul and Luke and Aristarchus and whoever else is with them, the full crew of a large ship through a terrifying storm that would have wiped out any other crew. And his hand guides them where they need to go, even though they could have been lost at sea, right? They make a few stops along the way, but they're going to get there. And he provides for all of them just what they need. And he displays his miraculous power. Right? First, the wind and the sea obey him, and then this poisonous snake obeys him, and then diseases obey him. Whatever we're going through in life, there is nothing that God can't get us through, right? Just as the Lord had a purpose for Paul, you know, for him to go to Rome, he has a purpose for each one of us, right? And he will fulfill that purpose no matter what. Nothing can thwart him. We are not done with this life until God is done with us. And so I think that's what we can take from this story. And
did I think that at any time did Paul realize that he was going to Rome to die at his last?
He knew, you know, well, he knew he was going to Rome. The way Paul lived his life, probably every day, he probably thought it's possible he could have been his last day. He was under constant threat of death. Especially all, you know, every day he was in custody, they could have just executed him at any point. So I think he always lived with that awareness. So anybody else got any closing thoughts? So next time, we will finish the book of Acts. So I'm excited.
Syracuse.
What's that?
We'll get to Syracuse.
We'll go to Syracuse. Here you go.
I got to see Paul. Get off the ship.
Never
you? Yeah. That's right.
Next reading will be close to home.